Hello, Popcorn Junkies, and welcome to this review of Dune Part 2. Now, I'd be lying if I didn't say this is a slightly daunting review to do, especially with a gravelly voice like I've got. In fact, I sound like a sandworm that's had its sort of, my mouth has been sort of pulled open and I've been dragged through the sand dunes of Arrakis. This is an epic film. It's the second part of Dune, the Frank Herbert 1965 classic, seminal book. You can see and feel its influence on episodes within Star Wars, such as The Return of the Jedi, certainly, you know, with Jabba's Hutt and that creature in the sand. It's an incredibly influential work. I remember reading it on the tube in the early 80s, mid 80s. And what drew me in, and I've talked about this before in reviews and reactions to trailers, was the extraordinary level of detail he went into when it came to the not just economic infrastructure of these worlds, houses, civilizations, groups, but also the complications of power struggles, the trading in spice. And I think that's the greatest strength of science fiction at its best, is that it extends upon what we know or what we can see happening, and then takes us forward in a way that kind of is believable, engageable with, and get on boardable with. And so Dune very much isn't that sort of world necessarily of weird creatures. I've read that there are weird creatures, you know, but, you know, just creatures for creature's sake, which you could argue, some would argue, that's what Star Wars is about. Whereas Star Wars and things like Guardians of the Galaxy, they're space operas. This is sci-fi. And I would argue that this part two by Denis Villeneuve, I know lots of people pronounce it differently, that's how I'm going to pronounce it, Denis Villeneuve, you know, this is in many regards, I would describe this film as sort of that rarity, which is intellectual or art house blockbuster. And it's rare that you get those two aspects colliding. I think probably a more recent example of them colliding successfully and in a big bang effect was something like Oppenheimer, where you've got a certain class and sophistication of filmmaking sort of chained to a story or a topic that a lot of people can get on board with. This is not sci-fi as in space opera silliness with lots of gimmicky kind of monsters, but it does have shoot-'em-ups, it does have tension, it does have sci-fi tech, it does have worlds and moons and all that kind of stuff, and spaceships and all that kind of malarkey, and it has great storytelling and brilliant acting in it too. But if you're coming to this for that sort of Marvel-esque kind of obvious sci-fi, this ain't your film. Denis Villeneuve directed the first Dune. He did other films like Arrival, which I found a bit slow, ponderous. He also did Blade Runner 2049, which I have the poster above my head. I'm a huge fan of Blade Runner. There were huge parts of Blade Runner 2049 I liked, but again, ponderous is something that is something I would use to describe my issue with some of his films. He's a visualist, you know. I mean, he storyboards the hell out of his films. He has a strong vision of how they're going to look, perhaps before he's even put actors in there. And it's often been described as an unfilmable feast. Dune, you know, David Lynch had a go at it years ago, and it was a failed attempt. I mean, to be fair, he had 40 minutes lopped out. He also had Sting. He tried to make it a bit weird and whacked. It missed its target. So this is sci-fi for grown-ups. This is Star Wars for grown-ups. If you were to just accept that in Dune 1, Paul Atreides loses his dad, and he's the sole survivor with his mum, Rebecca Ferguson, and they want to try and survive and sustain themselves, and he wants to get revenge on the death of his dad, I think that might be enough. So although I've said, you know, if you want the full experience, of course, see Dune 1. But if you haven't got the time, if you haven't got the inclination, I think you might be all right just kind of jumping in at the beginning of this film. Obviously, it stars Timothy Chalamet as the lead, Paul Atreides. It's very much Zendaya and Paul Atreides' film. It's their relationship, if you like, their coming of age, their falling in love across on this battered planet of Arrakis, as Paul Atreides seeks to avenge the death of his father, but also gets hooked into this narrative of the Fremen. On the planet of Arrakis, believing that he's the second coming. I mean, whenever I hear the word Messiah, I have to really fight hard to not be reminded of, you know, the Monty Python and the Holy Grail. He's not the Messiah, he's just a very naughty boy. And so, you know, this film is very much about the idea of, is he the Messiah? Are him and his mum not telling the truth about whether he's the Messiah? Are they using their own sort of skills, inherited skills, and their own layers of deceit and personal kind of ambition or revenge in order to convince the Fremen on Arrakis that they're the Second Coming. But anyway, whatever they're doing, they need to mobilise support. They need to mobilise the people of Arrakis, the Fremen, the underdogs, and in so doing, hopefully they'll be able to enact and mete out revenge. Also in there, massive attention has to be given to the fact that Austin Butler's in there, Florence Pugh is in there, Christopher Walken is in there, Josh Brolin is in there, who else is in there, Lea Seydoux is in there, Dave Bautista is in there, and Javier Bardem is in there too. And for me, Javier Bardem is an absolute kind of guilty pleasure in this film. He really is. He brings a certain sort of warmth and cheek to the film, because I think one thing you could say about Dune 1 was, you know, if you're looking for a sense of humour, there's not many laugh out loud moments in Dune. You're not sat there to laugh out loud, you're sat there to meditate. Really, watching Dune 1 and Dune 2, having watched them both now, it would be like sitting in a yoga room, getting into a room to do yoga, sitting in the, I don't know, what is it, the lotus sort of position with your hands like that, someone bringing in an enormous wind machine and firing sand at you and just saying, go om, for 6 hours. And I think probably in there somewhere there would be some benefit to your mental health. I think. Just keep your mouth shut. So as I say, the narrative is simple. Paul Atreides and his mum, Rebecca Ferguson. I love Rebecca Ferguson. Don't tell Nats, though, I know she's interviewed her. Oh my God, I was jealous. Rebecca Ferguson rocks tattoos on the face. She's beautiful, she's sharp, she's subtle. She has about 6 lines in this film, but she's in it a lot. But she's dark, she's twisted, she's all these things. She becomes a reverend mother and all this kind of stuff. So yeah, she's brilliant. I loved her in the first film. I loved the emphasis on her relationship with Paul Atreides and his dependence on a strong mother in the first film. I thought that was a really neat detail. They need to convince everyone in Arrakis that, you know, Paul Atreides is the Second Coming. It's the Messiah. Part of being able to convince the Fremen, of whom Javier Bardem is one of the lead kind of spokespeople and representatives, if you like, part of which also Chani, played by Zendaya, is part of this tribe too. But part of the process of this is convincing them. And they're helped immeasurably by the fact that Javier Bardem, he's got sort of rose-tinted glasses, or what? He's got sand-tinted glasses. He can't get enough of Timothée Chalamet. He believed he was, if he farted and filled his pants, Timothy, Javier Bardem would be like, you're the Messiah. The Messiah, this was written. This was written. And all the way through it becomes quite funny that this is a film actually about Javier Bardem's refusal to not believe that every single thing that happens has been written. This is so. And this is confirming that Paul Atreides is in fact the Messiah, not just a naughty boy. And so this is a film, at its simplest, about their survival and the extent to which they succeed or don't succeed at convincing the Fremen that they are the Messiah, and she is the Reverend Mother, and they are the Holy Trinity, if you like, and they've been sent to rescue the planet. And it's also about how they can enact some kind of revenge on the Emperor and on the Harkonnen. So you have the House of the Harkonnen. And of course, the House of the Harkonnen was most perfectly or most obviously denoted by Stellan Skarsgård in the first film, who played, what's his name again? Baron Vladimir Harkonnen, you know, a floating blob of personage with all sorts of kind of machinery keeping him going, a sort of modern, a futuristic but battered kind of, IV unit that he kind of carries around with himself. And, you know, so you've got this brilliant contrast. They're sort of, we meet the Harkonnen kind of off planet. And the Harkonnen are the ones that are mining Arrakis, or sapping it of its spice reserves. And so, you know, we're aware all the time that actually at the heart of this is the need to get this crop, this spice, this stuff that makes your eyes go blue. And if you get, I mean, brilliant details in there. If you ever find yourself, in the presence of a baby sandworm, and you manage to kind of, I don't know, sort of domesticate it, shove a bloody thing down its throat, and you can pour out the juice of life, the blue juice of life that will just go mental, make you see everything and go nuts, which is precisely what happens in this film. So it's a film packed to the gills and parked firmly within that world of faith, spiritual belief. And this is a film that gives you 10 minutes of meditative storytelling and character development, followed by 5 to 7 minutes of really neat, nifty, beautifully executed, quite stressful, beautifully shot action scenes, set pieces. And so, I mean, it's pretty formulaic, ironically, in that sense, for saying it's sort of intellectual kind of art house blockbuster. But it does that, and it does it well. So you're never, well, you know, you may get to certain points where you're thinking, okay, I've got enough of this kind of looking into blue eyes and sand and parking things in sand and boom, boom, making the sandworms come and all this kind of stuff. But always just around the corner is some new scene of violence or atrocity or horror or just kind of, you know, a mystery. It's a rich film, and it's well paced for saying it's nearly 3 hours long. It's also a film about who are you? I mean, all the best sci-fi films, if you think of Star Wars, you know, Luke Skywalker, who is his dad? I mean, that was the great big narrative bloody story for however long. You know, who's dad? Who's whose sister? Who's Princess Leia? Who Daisy Ridley? Who's Rey? Who's she? You know, who's who? Everyone is related to someone. And Dune 2, this is a spoiler review, Dune 2 speaks to a really neat discovery as to where half of, or part of, Paul Atreides and half of his mother, where their origins come from. And it does speak to, are we all made up of both good and evil? Are we all an amalgamation of the bad side and the good side and all this kind of stuff? So that's in there. So it's not just a film about faith. It's also a film about rebellion. It's also a film about a people being exploited. Ironically, it has really oddly kind of, there's huge metaphorical parallels going on with what's going on in the Middle East at the moment, not least because this is set in sandy environs. So you kind of thought, you know, it was often I was sort of thinking, God, this is weird, isn't it? The Harkonnen, they're the kind of imperialists controlling these Fremen, and the Fremen are scurrying around with not very much to try and resist. And so you can't help but feel, my God, this is like an age-old story. The film starts with Florence Pugh, the daughter of the Emperor. The Florence Pugh and sort of Christopher Walken exist in this kind of almost idyllic kind of, it's like a Rivendell from Lord of the Rings. They're sort of like elven kind of, they're in this kind of beautiful courtyard where you sort of think, where is this courtyard? Is it on a spaceship? Is it on another planet they live in? It's so beautiful. It's like Instagram perfect, you know? I mean, you've got sort of Instagram versus reality. Instagram where Chris Walken and Florence Pugh is, and she's writing a journal, which interestingly, when she writes a journal, it goes onto an old tube, like old scrolls, but metal, and oh, I love all that sort of stuff. Where are they? But they're in this kind of really neat, beautiful spa. They look like they're in a spa in Cornwall, just hanging out and chilling. But she's the device that takes us in. Very little of Florence Pugh in this, very little of Christopher Walken. I've heard a few people say they didn't like Christopher Walken in this. I thought it was great. I thought he just had all the kind of gravitas and kind of all of that kind of craggy old kind of stuff going on to kind of carry this. So you've got this scrambling kind of activity on the planet of Arrakis. They're kind of trying to take out these mining units that the Harkonnens are using. Dave Bautista is the Baron's kind of, you know, top in command, trying to make all the kind of mining work, but he's fucking up. I love this. There's a great now. Dave Bautista is clearly the put upon sort of, if not son, he's the put upon relative, isn't he? He can't quite get it right. He keeps making mistakes, and as you watch him make more mistakes, it was a curious emotion to feel in this film. Was every time I looked at Dave Bautista, you'd see him walking in towards someone or away from someone. He thought, don't careful, you're going to walk into a wall or something. He seemed to be gaff prone. He was making mistakes. Basically, Dave Bautista has an absolute mare in this film. Least of all, because then the Baron throws old Austin Butler at him. And Austin Butler is in here as Fade. I'm going to call him Austin because I can't say Fade Ruther, Fade Rather. He plays first of all, about the Harkonnens. When you cut to close-ups of Stellan Skarsgård with his blobby head, and he's got black stuff all over him, and he's been in a bath and all this kind of stuff, it's incredibly hard not to shake the image of Boris Johnson. You feel like you're watching perhaps a cabinet meeting of the Tory party. So for me, the Harkonnens quite quickly became the Tories, let loose, so to speak. But the brutality of the Harkonnens in this film is brilliantly shown. They used a special infrared camera to film many of the scenes around just the Harkonnens, sort of kind of taking away the sort of colour. I think there's the suggestion that the Harkonnens can't see colour, and so there's this sense that we have, you know, where the Harkonnens are and where they live and where they kind of engage in these gladiatorial kind of, you know, shows and what have you. So it's very empire. Having just come from Rome, I was reminded of the whole Colosseum, Imperial, all this kind of stuff. And so the Baron has got this, has basically got this cousin, is he? Is he a cousin? Why is he? Nephew. So Austin Butler plays the Baron's nephew. And we have this wonderful scene where essentially some of the few remaining individuals from Paul Atreides' house are drugged up and thrown into a gladiatorial ring, and Austin Butler gets to kill them. But because they're drugged up, it's really easy. Before that, we've had this scene where our introduction to Austin Butler is sensational. So they're just nutcases. So in order to test the sharpness of a knife, which is given to him, he's got all these kind of like lackeys around him. They look like it's like a harem. He likes sex and he likes killing. So he's basically, he loves the thrill of fucking and the thrill of killing, basically. And so he gets given this knife. And so he doesn't actually sort of test it. Most of us would just test a knife, wouldn't you? Try and chop our own finger off. And go, oh, yeah, that's really sharp. Yeah, I'm going to use that when I go and kill all the people who are drugged in an unfair fight. He doesn't. He goes, oh, that's sharp, but let's test it there. Taking out, basically garrotting the person next to him and slicing someone else over there. And we've had a scene earlier where we've just heard off camera the Baron, not very happy. A lot of slapping and watery sounds. And you go in and there's three bodies just in a corner that he's killed. They're a brutal bunch, the Harkonnens. It's kind of how the Tory party deal with their sort of leaders that fail. You know, I think something similar probably happened to Liz Truss. And so, you know, Austin Butler's really, he's nasty. He's really nasty and he's vicious. And I like that. If I'm honest, I could have done with even a little bit more. I felt we could have gone a little bit darker even. I could have done with a little bit. I mean, I felt he was going to a place which was just like Dennis Hopper-esque from Blue Velvet, but he didn't go there. I really liked all the gladiator stuff. You've seen them in the trailer. You know, it's the black and white footage of him fighting and all that kind of malarkey. And then clearly, a power struggle is encouraged between him and Dave Bautista. That's kind of neat. But the Fremen, all Arrakis, Paul Atreides and his mum are starting to succeed at convincing the Fremen that he is the second coming or the third coming or the first coming. I don't know. But he's the Messiah, not a naughty little boy. And she has. And what I think is quite neat about all of this is that it's a film in which you're invested in Paul Atreides and his mum surviving. But there are points in the film where your sympathy shifts away from them and towards Zendaya, who you begin to think, oh, is he using Zendaya? In what way are they using the plight, much as some would say George Galloway is doing with the Palestinians in his win in Rochdale? To what extent are they kind of leaping on the back of the Fremen's fight with the Harkonnens in order to beat the Harkonnens and get to the place being able to enact vengeance? And so there's that thing of what is real? How much of what Rebecca Ferguson is sort of suggesting she is, and she becomes this dark and twisted kind of, you know, she becomes tattooed and she's pregnant and she's drunk the water of the sandworm infant and it makes her eyes blue and it means she can talk to a baby, which is a baby to be played by Anya Taylor-Joy. You know, how much of this is real? How much is this them using biological skills that they've learned and got because of who they are and their genetics and all that kind of stuff? So you can't help it. I think that's quite clever, because although they're the heroes in a sense, they're the protagonists that we're rooting for, they're not wholly being kind to the Fremen. And I think Zendaya's narrative arc, her character's narrative arc, is a really different one, an interesting one in a film like this or a sci-fi like this, where she doesn't end up in the place you think she would end up. And their relationship doesn't end up in the place that you think they would. And I think this is a really important thing too. I think where you might have had a bit of doubt about Timothy Chalamet carrying something like this from the first film, and I have to confess, I don't think necessarily helped by the arrival of Wonka in between. I mean, I went into this thinking, oh my God, how am I going to be able to shake the image I just recently had of him bouncing around on, you know, edible flowers, dancing with Hugh Grant as an Oompa Loompa? I mean, am I going to be able to make this transition? The transition worked perfectly. I forgot Wonka, and I bought into this. But what Timothy Chalamet does, which is really good, through not many lines, is he has a certain sort of louche kind of adolescent disregard. He's kind of just looking and learning and taking it in. But it's very believable. And so I felt his growth in this film. And of course, both these films have the luxury of time. Maybe we don't have quite the luxury of time to watch them, but you know, he has the luxury of time to develop in this. And so I really enjoyed watching Paul Atreides begin to discover the scope of his power. Lovely buddy movie aspects to his relationship with Javier Bardem. Javier Bardem keeps throwing more and more kind of tests at him to prove that he's the Messiah. I mean, Javier Bardem thinks he'll be able to pull them all off. It's not that he's trying to catch him out, but he's like, yeah, just ride this worm, dude. It's easy. You know, you'll be able to do this because he's the Messiah. He's the Messiah. The great thing is if he dies, then he's not the Messiah. That's fantastic. I tell you what you don't want in life is someone to go, I think you're the Messiah. Because straight after it, they're going to say, ride this sandworm. So let's talk about some of the set pieces. So the opening skirmish, I really like that. The opening of the film was really neat, where you had floating soldiers. The Harkonnen suddenly just, they'd leap, but they kind of went really slowly up. Really kind of wrong-footed you. The tech was not overbearing. The suits weren't overbearing. It wasn't like someone had gone, right, let's go really far in one direction. It's a bit Mad Max-y. It's all in the sand. You believe the design of the suits. You believe the design of the sort of the vehicles, the mining, you know, the kind of mosquito-like flight, you know, sort of helicoptery type things and all that kind of stuff. But there was a wonderful moment in this first scene where as some of the Harkonnen were getting picked off and shot, they would fall with such a dead thud into the sand. I even recognised parts of where they'd filmed these scenes in Jordan. It was really weird. We've been in that valley. We've filmed in that valley. And so it was a really neat wrong-footing opening scene. It wasn't a big space. And, you know, you're not getting big space intergalactic bollocks. You're getting quite interesting, real landscapey kind of conflict, which I thought was neat. There was another one, a really neat kind of destruction of the mining vehicle, where there was a really believable exchange where Zendaya's character was trying to hit this mosquito helicopter thing. The only time she could fire it and hit it was when it fired, its guard would come down. And so, you know, you had some genuinely authentic kind of stress around some of these kind of action set pieces. Then, of course, you've got the worms. The weirdest thing for me is like, imagine saying you like Dune, but the one part of it you're not convinced of or sold on is the sandworms. I was like that with the book. I was never really entirely convinced by the whole sandworm thing. And I don't think I was in the first film, but I was in this one. And yet, the riding of the sandworms, very exciting scenes, beautifully done. You know, it's like a rites of passage to prove your Fremen quality messiah. You know, you've got to really impress Javier Bardem, and you've got to go with two sort of things and hook them on and ride that sandworm to buggery across. The question I wanted to ask, though, is once you're riding a sandworm, do any Dune aficionados here know, but once you're on the back of a sandworm, how do you stop it? I mean, is it like riding a horse? You just pull the rein to the right a bit or the rein to the left and they go right and left or the opposite, isn't it? But maybe with what I was worried about is what was going to make the sandworm go down? Because if it goes further down into the sand, I'm fucked. So how do they keep it? Is it about just sort of giving it a good old pull? Is that why there are a few close-ups on like the grapples being hooking into almost like gills, if you like? So you know, riding a sandworm, there's a lot of that stuff. I personally really liked all of the Harkonnen, Gladiator. I couldn't get enough of them. And I think, again, it's that classic thing of, I think they obviously got it right because I came out of the film wishing I'd had more. They don't, certain fight scenes and set pieces don't overstay their welcome. They give you a much needed burst of action, stress, adrenaline, and then you're back into the kind of sand and the portrait and the building of character and relationships and belief. This is all a film about building belief in Paul Atreides. Right down to even like, you know, the end duel between Austin Butler and Chalamet, which apparently they both did all of the kind of choreography and training. They did that scene, and there's some really rapid, fast action kind of moments in that. It's not long, and that's kind of refreshing. And yet, weirdly, although it's kind of refreshing that it was over quite quickly, I could have maybe done with a bit more. I don't know. I wanted a bit more. I wanted a bit more of Dave Bautista as well. I liked the fact that we had this character who couldn't put a foot right and he kept fucking up all the time, basically. And I could have done with even more of Austin Butler. I think I could have, this sounds awful, and it's not because I'm a pervert, but I think I could have done with another beat or a moment around Austin Butler's deviancy around love and sex rather than just around killing. But perhaps that really is a part of the kind of, you know, making it appeal to the family. Josh Brolin's in there. Josh Brolin didn't really bring much to it. I mean, he's obviously one of Paul Atreides' father's old commanders. I mean, he's crucial in that he tells Paul Atreides, there's a shitload of fucking atomic bombs over there in that cliff. And everyone's like, really? No one knew that. He said, yeah, we can use that as a kind of bargaining chip and negotiating power. Basically, it's the nuclear deterrent. I mean, Josh Brolin rides in and accidentally brings in the nuclear deterrent as an option for Paul Atreides and his mum as they negotiate against the Emperor and against the Harkonnens and what have you. The cinematography throughout is absolutely sensational. The colour, the grade is beautiful. As I understand it, I believe the cinematographer, who is Greg Fraser, I think he went through the process of filming film lenses, or filming on film first, then plopping it onto digital and then plopping it back onto film. I feel there's been some processing. I'm a huge fan of that, where you film something and then you film it, almost you film it and project it and film it again to give the film quality, the quality of the image has that spice feeling to it. When you look at close-ups of the sand where the spice is, and yet the spice is a sort of glinting gold in it, which is the drug or the spice or whatever, you know, whatever it is. And you know, this is the thing they're trading. You know, the film has that. I think I said with the first one, we came out feeling a little bit, I almost had an asthma attack. I mean, if you have asthma, take an asthma pump, because you do feel sometimes a bit, oh God, I've got too much sand in my lungs. And so, you know, all in all, I thought it's an incredibly meditative watch. It's a long watch. It didn't feel long watching it. I really bought into Paul Atreides and Chani's, Zendaya's love story. I thought that was really nice. I thought it was lovely. You know, there's lots of kind of moments of kind of, you know, experimental imagery, you know, with dreams and all that kind of stuff. Rebecca Ferguson's great. She becomes this. But I think what's really nice about all of it is it keeps you, if you're really thinking about why are the Fremen believing them? It keeps you in that position of, oh, I don't know entirely if I believe either Rebecca Ferguson or Paula or Timothée Chalamet. They're both conning everyone to another end. And when you see what happens with Zendaya in that final moment, you are led to think, oh, hang on a minute. You know, and the spoiler moment, this is a big spoiler moment. You know, given that we discover that Paul Atreides is half or quarter Harkonnen or part Harkonnen, and that his mum is half Harkonnen, you suddenly go, or maybe his mum's full Harkonnen, you go, oh, is this the brutality of the Harkonnen kicking through? And I think that's really rich, and I really like that. I felt that could have been, well, I mean, I got that from it. It doesn't encourage you to go there a lot. As I say, Javier Bardem gives much needed lightheartedness as well. And his, bless him, his kind of naive, but, you know, does believing matter? If even if there's nothing there to believe, if in believing it results in the right result, do you know what I mean? You know, so he's, let's say Paul Atreides isn't the Messiah. He's not the Messiah. And she's not the kind of, you know, she's not the, what is she? And she's not the Reverend Mother. But she's managed to sort of convince everyone she is the Reverend Mother. Does it matter if it gives the Fremen the belief they needed to overcome the Harkonnen or to overcome the Emperor or to go south? I mean, the feeling at the end of this film is very much the biggest battle is yet to come. And of course, there is much talk of Dune 3 or Dune Messiah coming. You know, but I like this idea of a fraudulent Messiah or a not to be believed Messiah. And then it just speaks to that whole thing of does it matter that they're believing in a false Messiah if the belief yields them the leader they want, the leader they need, the fight for freedom that perhaps they're all after anyway. So I think it is a film that engages with that stuff. It's not obvious goodies and baddies. It's all about alliances. You've got a sense that outside of this world, you know, Arrakis, there's a whole host of other houses all vying for support and vying for attention and vying for control. I thought this was a sensational piece of filmmaking. I really enjoyed it. What I want from something like this is escapism, and it's total, total escapism. And I think the fact that it's set within a world, okay, none of us live in a desert, but we know deserts and we have them. There was so much that was graspable and believable and identifiable and relatable, in a sense, within what we saw. Extra relatable given the nature of the Middle Eastern crisis at the moment. That I felt there was a lot to get on board with. And so it was a much more nuanced film about, you know, the put upon, the controlled, the imperialism, the control, and the mining of the natural resources of this planet, which results in the mining of the natural resources of the indigenous people. You know, all those sorts of things are in there. I thought it was sensational. It was exquisite. I want to see it again. It does everything that, for me as a child, cinema is supposed to do. It transported me away into a completely different world, and it asked me to have feelings that weren't ludicrously sort of obtuse and surreal and extreme and unrelated to feelings that we have in the real world. So, and I cared about everyone. And I think it was a great moment for Zendaya. I don't know, a lot of people aren't fans of Zendaya's. I thought she was really neat in there, and I really believed in their relationship. I loved their sort of companionship as much as their romance too. Soundtrack, sensational. I mean, you can't go wrong with Hans Zimmer, can you? It's like you can't separate the soundtrack from the sound from the picture. It's like they've become they're like a sandworm all of their own. So tell me what you think. What were your thoughts? Did you like it as much as Dune 1? I think, I know a lot of people talk about, oh, I preferred this to the first one. I've said that. I've said, I think I prefer Dune 2 to Dune 1. It's stupid, really. I think the two are just necessary parts of telling a big story. And Dune 1 is different. But this is, I think some are saying, is this The Empire Strikes Back in the mix of those Star Wars films? A lot of people thought The Empire Strikes Back was the jewel in the crown of the Star Wars franchise. And in summary, before I give it a score, you know, as I say, it's a film that really marries intellectual arthouse-ness, so it can become more arthouse and intellectual for those in the audience that want that, with blockbuster. There's so much there to get on board with if you just want a rip-roaring good ride and to sort of feel a sensory kind of rush of difference and science fictioniness and all that kind of stuff. It speaks to ideas of faith and belief and purpose and all that kind of stuff. And I also thought it was just, again, intriguing, as I said earlier, that it's a film about the underdogs, the Fremen. It's a film about an indigenous people fighting a colonial occupier. And isn't it interesting how in the film world, you know, Star Wars, Guardians, so many other, you know, this Dune, the freedom fighters, the rogue forces, the rebel forces, the rebellion, the rebel alliance, all this stuff, they're idealized, they're the heroes. They're the ones we should be supporting and understanding. And isn't it interesting we can't even have that discussion in certain scenarios in the real world today? Score, I have to give it 100 out of 100. I thought it was sensational.
Thank you.